of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Riley, Judge Bratford, the Honorable Renee L. Werke presiding.
And again, good morning to everyone, and thank you for participating in our oral argument calendar today, October 7, 2020, by GovZoom. We all seem to have our issues with being able to effectively, or as we wish we could, appear, but over and above the fact that Ms. Johnson is not a visual, if anyone has any problems during the presentation of the arguments, please say something or raise your hand, do something so that you call it to my attention, and I will stop the timekeeper so that we can fix whatever needs to be done. The Zoom Gov hearings are the same as in the Court of Appeals oral argument calendar. You'll each have 15 minutes to present your case in chief. Appellate counsel, if you wish to use your 5 minutes for rebuttal, that is in addition to your 15 minutes. When you are ready to proceed, please indicate who you are and which party you are speaking on behalf of. Ms. Johnson, when you're ready to proceed, go ahead.
Judge Werke, may I ask Ms. Johnson a question, please, before we begin?
Yes.
The question is, Ms. Johnson, can you see us so you'll know when we may want to ask a question?
Yes, I can see all of you. I can see four people.
Good, and you can see the clock, too, which is about to
be. And the clock. Okay. I can see three judges and Ms. Nyhus and the clock.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Judge Werke.
Go ahead then, Ms. Johnson.
May it please the court, my name is Joy Johnson. I am the attorney for the appellant in this matter, Lisa Ann Olson. This is an appeal that is primarily about the issue of contract interpretation within the context of a criminal case. I believe that the issue is one of first impression, as there isn't any case law that establishes precedent in Minnesota. At trial, the parole evidence gathered during discovery that would assist in determining the meaning of the ambiguous contract terms was excluded. It is well established that contract interpretation is a matter of law in the civil side of practice. And this issue is reserved for the courts to decide, as it is a matter of law. Here, the ambiguous contract was given to the jury to determine. Again, without the benefit
there, Ms. Johnson, because that's one of the concerns I had in going through the briefing in this matter and trying to bring myself up to date with the facts of the case. I'm not really sure how you're framing this, and I understand that this is an unusual case because you're kind of mixing civil and criminal. Are you arguing that this is a jury instruction issue?
Perhaps it is. But I think it's more complicated than that. I think what we have here is an issue that ultimately is a legal question. It's not a fact-based question. It's a legal question that needs to be determined by a court, not a jury.
Our problem, of course, is if we don't know what your approach is, we have to determine what's, as a reviewing court, what standard of review we implement in determining how this shakes out. And so we're trying to determine whether this would be a jury instruction issue, and we'd look at it under harmless error, we'd look under plain error. How would you suggest we address this?
Sure. I'm not sure what we would give jury to instruct this. I think it gets complicated when we talk about giving a legal question to the jury to decide. Do we preface that with an expert and bring them up to date on how to interpret a contract that has two or more reasonable ambiguous terms? I think that's a very murky area when we start talking about giving this to the jury, when jurors are not tasked normally to look at questions of contract, nor are they allowed to do legal interpretations. So I'm not sure that giving this to the jury is an appropriate approach here. I think if we were in a civil court, that wouldn't happen. I don't think we would get this to a jury and the civil court and say, well, it could mean this or it could mean that, but we want you to figure that out. I'm not sure that would be appropriate in that context.
Oh, Ms. Johnson, I'm trying to understand your argument. The part of the jury instruction said Gabriel Richwine is entitled to income through an annuity. Is Is that what you're saying is incorrect? I'm trying to understand where you're assigning the error.
So the question in the jury instructions did ask the jury to determine whether the money did belong to Gabriel Richwine. That is one of the reasonable interpretations of the contract of the two ambiguous clauses. So the jury determined that the money did belong to Gabriel Richwine. However, they didn't have the benefit of the parole evidence that went along with that. The judge excluded that.
If that is the case, you have not cited any authority for the proposition that you're now trying to ask us to adopt, that ambiguous criminal contracts need to be decided by the district court. What authority do you have to support that?
The Minnesota Court of Appeals does not publish a standard of review for contract interpretation in a criminal matter. None that I found. I found plenty of authority on the civil side. I didn't find any authority on the criminal side. So I'm not sure how we go about presenting this to a jury. And it's pretty clear. There's a long established history on the civil side that this is a question of law, and questions of law need to be determined by the court. So I'm not sure how we get there on the criminal side when we don't have precedent to guide this. That was the trial court's problem as well. When we discussed this at the new trial hearing, the trial court judge said that, you know, basically resolving one of the issues that would be the contract interpretation would in essence be taking an element away from the state to have to prove, and instead the court would have to prove or make a determination on that. The court was clearly not comfortable entertaining the idea of having the court make a contract interpretation. But at the same time, now we've got an issue of law that has gone to the jury. And I'm not sure that that's the right thing either when we don't allow jurors to make legal determinations in our system.
So, counsel, we do allow jurors to determine factual issues like parties' intent and what in an ambiguous contract, the intentions of the parties or the contracting parties is important. And it seems to me that that's why you've offered the parole evidence that you've included in your addenda. So I guess, going back to what error you're citing to us, are you primarily focused on the district court's decision not to allow parole evidence? You also mentioned that out of the gate. And I'm just trying to understand. So are you seeking a new trial where you get to offer this parole evidence and where it's the district court that then decides the meaning of this ambiguous contract? I'm just not clear on the relief.
So if the court determines that it is proper for a jury in this instance to determine a contract, then I feel that the contract should be interpreted using the parole evidence that would help explain any ambiguity. There's two very clear meanings here in this contract. One is the money belongs to Joyce Richwine, the mother, while she's alive. And then who gets the money after Joyce Richwine passes? Because the clause in the contract says that Gabriel Richwine is entitled to this money for his own care and use while he's a minor. It doesn't address what happens when he reaches majority. So we've got Joyce Richwine that takes the money until her death, as long as Gabe Richwine is still with us, because he is a measuring life here. So at the point of Joyce Richwine's passing, who takes the money? The heirs of her estate. That's what we're left to determine. So we've got one reading is that the money belongs to Gabe Richwine. The next reading says that this can be bequeathed in her estate and go to who she appoints to have the money. And in this case, the reasonable people would be her two daughters. So in that regard, the only way that you can determine what the intent of
why is the mother that it's her two daughters and not her three children, for instance?
So Joyce Richwine, the mother, left significant paperwork that left everything to her two daughters, bank accounts, insurance policies. And there was even a form in this case, unexecuted, but a form in the mother's handwriting that left the money for the Allstate beneficiary to her two daughters, and it excluded Gabe, as he's not mentioned on the form. I did investigate that form, and it has never been published on the web. It had to be mailed from Allstate. And that paper was found in Joyce Richwine's possession.
Are these the documents are you referring now to the documents that were not a part of the record? Not a part of the court
yes.
trial record? And you acknowledge yes. they aren't a part of the trial court record?
I do.
All right, those would not properly then be before us if they have not, if they haven't been in district court.
Correct. They were excluded as irrelevant.
All right, I understand, correct me if I'm wrong. I understand that you withdrew your motion after the district court ruled that parole evidence was inadmissible, and then you withdrew your motion?
Yes, she admitted, the trial court stated that the parole evidence in this case, in the file that we had received from the insurance company, unless Lisa Olson could authenticate the document, the trial court said the documents could not come in. Thus, we didn't get the parole evidence, which explained quite a bit of detail in several different documents, what these contract terms meant and where the money should have gone if something like Joyce Richwine passed before Gabriel Richwine. So, you know, here we are with a guilty verdict, and the jury.
Oh, counsel, if I can follow up just briefly on that. So if you withdrew the documents after the judge made the ruling on parole evidence and they're not in the record in district court, then I guess I have to ask you whether you preserved this issue for our review, because you're supposed to file, you know, challenge documents or evidence you're supposed to preserve in some way for us to review. And it's not by attaching them as an addendum. It's by somehow placing it in the district court record, some sort of an offer of proof or filing of a court exhibit. So if you could address
they were offered, that. Thank you. They were offered in our new trial hearing as documentation in there, I believe. I'm almost positive they were in there.
So you're saying they were filed with the district court, but during the new trial motion?
I believe they were attached to my brief.
Because it was my understanding they hadn't been filed at all in district court.
Okay, then maybe they hadn't.
Okay, so you're not sure. We can find that out. Actually, thank you. Yeah.
Actually, they were filed as well in a pretrial motion after the omnibus hearing that I believe happened on August 12 of 2018.
Right, and then after that, you withdrew your motion. Another kind of gave up because the district court indicated what its ruling was.
Correct.
Okay, just so I understand how this played out. Okay, thank you.
And then I continue, you know, I challenged it at the new trial hearing on issue. So we're back to the issue of, we have a fairly poorly drafted contract here from dating from 1989. That has two or more reasonable meanings that the jury is not equipped to handle. They don't have a legal background. They don't have contract interpretation. They don't have an education in this. And yet here they are deciding what the contract means, which seems arbitrary and capricious, and come up with a determination on who they think the money belonged to. And as far as preserving this issue for appeal, we're talking about justice here. We're talking about what is right and what is fair to Lisa Olson in this case. We're talking about the deprivation of her liberties here. Based on the testimony at trial, Lisa Olson testified that she believed that this was her money, and she testified why she believed this was her money.
But didn't the jury also hear the conflicting testimony that Olson told a neighbor or someone else that GR had enough money to send nieces and nephews to college, and then there were bank records that showed annuity checks were deposited into your client's checking account, and then the checking account was switched when one check went to Gabriel, and then it was redeposited back. I mean, that's other testimony the jury heard. Isn't that going to the weight of the testimony?
Perhaps, but as it related to the college comment, which Ms. Olson denied ever making that comment.
But the jury can either disregard or accept that based on the weight they give to the whoever has made those statements in court, right?
True.
Your client said no, and somebody else said that's what she said.
Correct. But that doesn't lead us to a comfort with how the jury arrived at determining the legal interpretation of this contract. So how do we jump from, okay, well, I believe she said that she had enough money to send her nieces and nephews and children to college. How does that translate into interpreting this document in two ambiguous clauses? I don't think that comment, if it were even true, has a lot of bearing on who the money belongs to within the contract.
Well, to Judge Wolfie's point, the checks were made out to Lisa Olson and Pamela as guardians of Gabriel, or Representative Olson as guardian of Gabriel. So that's pretty unambiguous. And that's how Allstate is making the checks out.
Yes. So there was testimony from the Allstate record custodian, Jean Sanford, and from Ms. Olson herself. Jean Sanford testified, as did Ms. Olson, that at a point early on when Olson began receiving this money, first of all, the money came to all three of their names directly without a designation of who, the like guardian or anything like that. It said all three names on it.
When, Ms. Johnson, if you can wrap up, you are out of time and you'll have rebuttal. But go ahead and finish your statement.
Thank you. Ms. Olson received a phone call from, testified, and so did Sanford, testified about they ran out of character space on the check line and had to diminish the number or the amount of characters on the line. So Gabriel had to be kept on there because he was a measuring wife and attached to the file. I don't think it necessarily means that it belonged to Gabe. I think it was a convenient way for Allstate to get the check out with limited characters. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. We will turn to respondent counsel.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Dawn Nyhus, and I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this case. The state was prepared on the first point of counsel's argument, appellant's argument, to talk about how we believed counsel had framed this issue in the briefing process, which was that there was a plain error in an unobjected to jury instruction that essentially put the state to its full burden of proof on the elements of the offense, and using a standard instruction that incorporated the alleged facts at trial as presented by the state. Your Honors, based on that understanding that was the challenge raised by appellant, I think that it is clear, looking at that plain error test, that the appellant is unable to satisfy that burden before the court. First of all, again, going back to how this issue was framed and briefed for the court, this was a standard jury instruction, CrimJig 16.69. That instruction specifically allows for the space to discuss a material fact. I think that appellant is hard pressed to argue that something that is blatantly indicated as a material fact is now a question of law. That is why I believe that counsel hasn't found authority to support that position. Both attorneys agreed, or I should say sets of attorneys agreed with the court as to the proposed language, and it was presented to the jury consistent with the alleged facts here going forward. What I do see that appellant has touched upon in briefing is actually, I think, counter to her point that when there is a dispute on the existence or terms, even in a contract, that can be a question for the fact finder. But what I think is important for this court to also understand is, and I believe that Judge Werke and Judge Riley touched on this a moment ago, there was a lot of evidence presented to the jury. We are not simply talking about the order for wrongful distribution for wrongful death or that petition. The jury had a lot of even non-contract evidence to consider on all of these points. And that was also well within the keeping of the law. Appellant was also...
Are you saying that even if the judge was wrong in submitting this to the jury, that there was independent evidence that that this would not have had a substantial effect on her rights?
Absolutely, Your Honor, that is correct. That evidence was just a piece of what was presented, including testimony, including bank records, checks that have Gabriel Richwine's name emblazoned on them. And there was not an issue here. If counsel is now asking this court to resolve what it believes is a legal question, I don't believe that that's the task of this court today. I believe we're looking at any correction of error, which appears to be a bit of a moving target, but with what the respondent understands, the appellant is arguing that the instruction was incorrect and it was improperly an instruction that the court should have made a decision on. Taking that to its fullest argument, if you will, if in fact that piece of the instruction was meant to be a question of law, this is what we're presented with, that the district court would have either determined ahead of time, yes, Gabriel Richwine was entitled to this income through an annuity. By virtue of that, it would have alleviated the state's burden of proof on that fact, which I think is inappropriate. Or if the court had said, we have determined as a question of law that he was not entitled to that income through an annuity, that would have, I believe, pervaded the province of the state as the charging function. And really would have asked for essentially a directed verdict before the case had even been presented. So I think what counsel's asking for here is a remedy that's not existent and not appropriate. On the parole evidence issue, I would say that I think that the court can see that the district court had a number of questions and concerns about compliance with the rules of evidence, foundation, authentication on a number of those documents. They were not and are not before this court. And it is part of the reason that I also filed my motion to strike. I'm not going to comment on that further because I think that that's clear. But based on all of this, I don't believe that there is a showing by appellant that there's been a plain error on the instruction, did not affect Ms. Olson's substantial rights. It is clear instead that the jury considered all of the evidence, including the defense theory and the evidence they presented. And the jury simply rejected that and found that the state had met its burden of proof. So we are asking this court to uphold the verdict, not to grant a new trial concerning any of that argument as to the first point. Your Honors, I also understand that the court had a number of questions for appellant on the first point only. The state, the respondent has briefed and talked about the second point that was raised by appellant. I'm not going to fully reiterate the state's argument here, but again, in looking at the state's treatment of the exhibit that was at trial that the appellant is now challenging, I believe that when the court looks at, again, the modified plain error approach, appellant has not demonstrated to this court a clear and obvious error, contravention of law or rule. And even if they had, to get to the third point, there is no reasonable likelihood that either a more precise recitation of the state's redaction or playing the entire audio would have again had a significant impact on the jury verdict. I will say that the evidence that was desired by the appellant to come in, which was largely the focus of one sentence that the investigator made on a comment, was before the jury. That testimony was elicited not once, but twice, to the jury through the investigator. And so again, I believe looking at that test, there is no error, there's no plain error. And again, no fundamental disruption of the administration of justice or process such that a very extreme remedy like a new trial would be warranted on that point either. Your Honors, we are asking that this court uphold the verdict, not grant a new trial. And that's all I have in terms of my prepared arguments, but certainly would answer any questions that the court has.
It appears there's no questions. Thank you, Ms. Nyhus. And we will then return to you, Ms. Johnson. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you'll delay just a minute till we have the timekeeper ready to go. You can proceed.
Thank you. Here, Ms. Nyhus discussed the issue of the state and the burden of proof here on the issue of intent with the contract interpretation. Ms. Nyhus says that having the court interpret the contract here would be taking an issue away from the state to prove, and in essence, making a determination on that point. On that same token, by giving this issue of contract interpretation to the jury to decide, we're taking that away from the state to prove. There's no argument here really for one contract interpretation over the other. There wasn't any testimony at trial for teasing out the different meanings behind these two different clauses and giving weight to one or the other and comparing and contrasting it with the available evidence. As far as the available evidence at trial, appellant was able to submit about 10 exhibits for a total of maybe 15 to 20 pages. Not that this is a numbers game, but there was probably an estimated 5,000 pieces of evidence during discovery in this case. It was a very paper heavy case. And out of 5,000 pieces of evidence and documents in this case, appellant got about 18 of them into the file in about 10 exhibits. So there's a lot that wasn't teased out here that speaks a lot to the contract interpretation. We had two different insurance companies, home insurance company, Allstate insurance company. We had documents from a group home and other documents from the state. So lots of evidence, very little of that got in front of the jury. On the issue of the second issue in this appeal, with the redaction that wasn't disclosed prior to trial or even at the time of trial, it was told to Ms. Knight has disclosed
Ms. Johnson
on her
Ms. Johnson
her, yes.
Three judges sitting on the panel were all trial court judges and trial lawyers. And my experience when only a portion of a tape is played or recounted, that if the person who is on the other side thinks parts have been left out, they immediately say, we want the whole thing played. And that's the remedy, it seems to me. And you didn't ask to then play the redacted portion that you find so troubling to the jury.
Yes, thank you for bringing up that point. This trial took place the 28th, 9th, 30th, and 31st of January, 2019, during that cold snap we had that was minus
tax, but you withdrew
the polar vortex. Thank you.
Yeah, but you withdrew and that as part of your motion, post-trial motions.
But it plays into why we didn't press to have another 20 minutes added to this trial. It was day three of this trial that this late in the day. It was after the afternoon recess, and we hadn't even begun our case yet.
Well,
and
perhaps that also could be deemed trial strategy. Maybe for whatever reason, whatever wasn't played was damaging. How would we know that? sometimes you don't want information to go to the jury. You don't want the full tape to go. You're telling us now it was because of a timetable and concern because of the cold and the jury's patience level and so on, but how do we know it wasn't trial strategy?
I never made any objection at all to this document or to this audio recording. I didn't have a problem with it in its entirety, period, even though it talked about a charge in there that my client wasn't tried on. It was that charge was dismissed prior to trial. That didn't bother me.
As I understand it, the state told you the day before that they had redacted it and said, do you want to listen to it? And so you certainly could have listened to it that night after trial and decided whether or not you wanted the whole thing played. And you didn't take the stand on that offer, according to the
record. You're right. I could have listened to it had Ms. Nihas provided me a copy of the redacted audio, which she never did. Nor did she provide me a copy of the redacted transcript if one existed. I was never given a redacted copy. I would have been more than happy to review that night, but I was never afforded that copy.
All right. We understand your argument and your time has expired. Anything else you want to say as far as summation?
No, thank you.
All right, thank you to both attorneys for appearing today in this fashion. The case is under advisement and a decision will be issued in the statutory timeframe. Thank you.
Thank you.